Podcast. I'm your host, Nashad Carrington. Today's episode will be a bit different than the others we've done, but should hopefully be just as good and as well received as some of our more popular episodes thus far. Now, generally we try to do episodes on interesting persons from history who've made a significant impact on the culture or history, or even particular events that have helped shape the course of the diaspora, or things that have been lost in time. Now, today's episode won't disappoint in the aspect of cultural relevance, but likely is a person you've heard of, especially in more recent years, as there has been a resurgence of interest in his work and his legacy. So, Jean-Michel Basquiat was born on December 22, 1960, in Brooklyn, New York. His ethnic background was Haitian through his father, an immigrant born in Port-au-Prince, and Puerto Rican through his mother, also born in Brooklyn. Now, he was born the second of four children to Matilda Andrades and Gerard Basquiat. I probably messed up his mother's last name. It's suggested that his mother is the one who actually instilled and inspired the love of art into her son by taking him to various art museums across Manhattan and even enrolling him as a member of the Brooklyn Museum of Art. His father was rough and rugged, and hardened really through the experiences of being born into a bourgeoisie family in Haiti that dealt with the harsh regime of Papa Doc Duvalier. Basquiat would later describe to friends and close loved ones that he was often beaten by his father and that he had had actually few friends growing up. But the story and background created by Basquiat of his upbringing and childhood later recounted didn't exactly correlate to the reality that his father and his brother would later tell. His father would tell a story that suggested, yes, his family was tormented by the Duvalier regime in Haiti, with both his father and mother being put in jail and his own brother being killed. But Gerard would suggest that he came to America at the age of 20, became an accountant, and married Matilda, and the both of them would work hard and prosper. He would say, Jean-Michel, for some reason, liked to give the impression that he grew up in the ghetto. I was driving a Mercedes-Benz, and we lived in a four-story brownstone we owned in Borum Hill, a couple of blocks from the Brooklyn Academy of Music. So which version is correct? I don't know, and I won't venture to guess, but I give a lot of credence to the recounted story of his father. Now, that's not to suggest that Basquiat didn't have an innate artistic ability. Just because you hang out in a museum and stare at a Van Gogh doesn't mean you'll be able to paint like him or suddenly improve your drawing skills. I think I personally am a testament to that in my own right, meaning I don't really have much artistic ability. Well, Basquiat had an interest in art that was developed from his mother's insistence and encouragement, but he himself learned to draw just by teaching himself through practice, taking place on sheets of paper his father would bring home from work. Now, at the age of seven, Basquiat, together with a friend from school, created a children's book. It was written by Basquiat and illustrated by his friend. Now, though Basquiat would later become the artist, he was the one that did the writing. The friend is the one who did the artwork to it. When he was 8 years old, Basquiat was playing in the street and got hit pretty severely by a car. And resulting from the accident, he suffered a broken arm, numerous internal injuries, and even had to have his spleen removed. And when he was recovering from these injuries, his mother brought him the book Gray's Anatomy, and this book would grossly shape his artistic outlook. Now, by the age of 11, Basquiat was fluent in French, Spanish, and English, and during his childhood, he lived in New York, Puerto Rico, and then back to New York City by 1976. When he was 13, Basquiat's mother was involuntarily committed to a mental institution, and for the rest of her life would be shuttled back and forth between institutions and home commitments. Now, by the age of 15, Basquiat had ran away from home and took to sleeping on park benches in Manhattan's East Village before being arrested and returned to his father after about a week. Not long after the incident of running away from home, Basquiat dropped out of high school entirely from Edward Morrow in Brooklyn in only the 10th grade. He would then attend an alternative school in Manhattan that was actually home to numerous artistic students who just couldn't quite make it at conventional school. But after he dropped out, and though he was attending the alternative school, his father kicked him out of the house entirely, causing Basquiat to stay with friends and couch surf in Brooklyn, and making him make ends meet, really, by selling t-shirts and homemade postcards. Now, Basquiat's work would go from his father's sheets of paper to the subway trains of New York, which is actually where he got his first take of public fame. under the name SAMO, standing for Same Old S-H-I-T, in the late 70s. As a preteen, Basquiat worked with a close friend to put graffiti on the trains and buildings around various parts of Manhattan. In 1976, Basquiat and his friend Al Diaz began spray painting graffiti on buildings in Lower Manhattan. Often the designs would feature messages referencing his SAMO pseudonym, namely short poems or phrases such as SAMO saves idiots, plush safe think he think SAMO, or SAMO as an end to mindwash religion, nowhere politics and bogus philosophy, or SAMO as an end to playing art. Sounds kind of convoluted or nonsensical, but that's what he was writing. In 1978, Basquiat began working in the art department for the Unique Clothing Warehouse, but at night he would retake the SAMO moniker and continue to spread his original graffiti. By 1979, Basquiat formed a noise rock band, first called Test Pattern, and then renamed to Gray. The group would play each Wednesday, where Basquiat would also display his SAMO artwork. In 1980, Basquiat would actually go on to star in an independent film called Downtown 81. In 1981, Basquiat starred in a Blondie music video for the song Rapture as a nightclub DJ. Now here's an interesting tidbit of information. The role that Basquiat played in the music video was actually originally intended for Grandmaster Flash. After struggling to get his work noticed and selling random items, Basquiat's big break actually came in 1980. He was fortunate enough to have his work featured with a group in an art show. In June of 1980, he participated in the Times Square Show, a multi-artist exhibition that was sponsored by the Collaborative Projects Incorporated and Fashion Moda. By September of the same year, he had joined the Anina Noisy Gallery and worked in the basement under the gallery toward his first one-man show that would go on to take place in March of 1981. In December of 1981, René Ricard actually published an article titled The Radiant Child in Art Forum magazine, and it featured Basquiat. And from there, he was brought to the attention of the art world. His unique fusion of words and symbols and stick figures and animals was something that hadn't really been seen before. Needless to say, the uniqueness of his work garnered critical acclaim. It wasn't long before the art-loving public fell in love with his style, and his original works were going for upwards of $50,000. Now, I think I've come to realize that in every episode we've had thus far, at some point, I dive kind of off topic, talking about a relevant but kind of unrelated topic. But I only hope that it's reasonably relates back and gives some insight to what we're talking about. And of course, I only say that because today's no different. In the late 1970s, a painting and sculpture style hit the scene. It was also known as the New Wild Ones. Well, neo-expressionist artists' work was characterized by intense subjectivity of work and very rough handling of materials. The style predominantly developed as a reaction to conceptual art and minimal art that featured prominently in the early 1970s. Neo-expressionist artists were unafraid to portray the human body in rough, violent ways, and namely used vivid colors to portray their sentiments. The style dominated the art scene until about the mid-1980s, but during the height of the movement, before and after, the social and economic value of the movement was hotly contested, especially by more traditional art buyers and critics, but with its popularity, obviously the general public enjoyed it. Now, Basquiat's particular style has been described as, quote, revolving around single heroic figures, athletes, prophets, warriors, cops, musicians, kings, and the artist himself. In his work, the head is often a central focus, topped by crowns, hats, and halos. In this way, the intellect is emphasized. Lifted up to notice, privileged over the body and the physicality of these figures, i.e. black men, commonly represented in the world. The work of Basquiat was inspired by his graffiti past. As we discussed before his painting career began, Basquiat was selling punk-inspired postcards for sale and then became known for his poetically charged graffiti under the pseudonym SAMO. During this time, while honing his skills, he would draw on random items, including other people's property quite often. His background as a punk postcard creator and poetic graffitist shaped his art. And if you ever have the pleasure to see a Basquiat, especially in person, you'll notice that his paintings are usually covered with text and codes of all kinds, including works, letters, words, numerals, phrases, logos, map symbols, amongst many other things. Now, Basquiat's work was ripe with symbology and references to African history as well. In 1983, Basquiat produced an untitled work, but it's commonly known as The History of the Black People, that is believed to depict the reclaiming of Egyptians as Africans and subverts the common concept of ancient Egypt being the cradle of Western civilization. In the center of this painting, Basquiat actually shows an ancient Egyptian boat being guided down the Nile River by Osiris, the Egyptian god of earth and vegetation. On the right side panel, Basquiat painted the words esclave, slave, esclave. On the left panel, Basquiat painted two Nubian-style masks. The rest of the painting contains images of the transatlantic slave trade juxtaposed with images of the Egyptian slave trade that had taken place centuries earlier. According to critics, the painting depicts what Western society has elected to forget and encourages the diaspora to forget as well, that Egyptians were black and blacks were enslaved. Now, another piece made by Basquiat in 1981, Irony of Negro Policeman, was created to illustrate how African Americans have been controlled by the predominantly white society. Now, in this piece, Basquiat sought to show how complicit African Americans have become with the institutionalized forms of whiteness and the corrupt nature of the power inherent in white regimes, even years after the Jim Crow era had ended. Now, this next part is eerily akin to kind of the situation in the present day, at least here in the United States. Now, Basquiat found the concept of the black policeman rather ironic. In his view, the policeman should have the ability to sympathize with his fellow black friends, family, ancestors, and neighbors, but instead, he was there to enforce rules designed by white society. In his view, the black policeman had, as famed Arthur Frantz Fanon called, black skin with a white mask. Now, in this painting, Basquiat showed the policeman is large to depict the excessive and totaling power inherent in the position, but he fragmented and broke the policeman's body into pieces. On top, surrounding the policeman's head, Basquiat depicted a hat that looks more like a cage to represent the constrained perceptions of African Americans at the time and how constrained a black policeman's perceptions were within a white society. Now, in the mid-1980s, Basquiat had a famed collaboration with pop artist Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol, the same one that painted the Campbell soup cans and just is very famous for pop art. So this union actually resulted in a show of their works that featured more than anything a series of corporate logos and cartoon characters. I'm not going to dive too deep into it. The two of them had a great friendship. And they worked together for about 5 years. And the collaboration with Warhol lasted until 1985. And really, to let the truth be known, much of Warhol and Basquiat's connection was based on publicity and less on well-received art, mainly because the art collaboration was not very well-received by critics and even art collectors. While I'm sure those pieces are very, very valuable today, and become staples of people's collections, museums, and personal collectors alike. They were really kind of shunned. Pieces just weren't very popular. But outside of the exhibitions with Warhol, Basquiat continued to capitalize on his fame and continued to travel and exhibit his work around the United States and around the world. In 1986, he was fortunate to travel to the Ivory Coast for a show in Abidjan. That same year, at only 25 years old, Basquiat exhibited nearly 60 paintings at the famed Kestner Gesellschaft Gallery in Hanover, Germany, becoming the youngest artist to ever showcase their work in the gallery. Though his work was amazing, and he was more than respected amongst collectors with pieces going for top dollar, Basquiat took major issue with much of the criticism he received. While it was clear he had many influential supporters, He railed and hated the fact that much of the art establishment didn't accept or anoint him in the same way that collectors did. His work wasn't represented in the famed Saatchi collection, mainly because Charles Saatchi never liked his work. But even worse, though the New York-based galleries of MoMA and the Whitney owned a few of his pieces, he had never been afforded a museum show, instead being relegated to smaller galleries and exhibits. Worst of all, in Basquiat's mind, was the reference by which much of the art establishment called him, that being the label given to him as a graffiti artist. In Basquiat's view, the word graffiti had just become another word for nigger. Now, as Basquiat's fame and relative fortune began to grow around the globe, so unfortunately did his drug use and addiction. At the same time as his star was rising high, his work reaching new heights of value and galleries clamoring for his exhibitions, his close friends began to get increasingly concerned about his drug use becoming excessive. He became increasingly paranoid and often isolated himself from the world for longer and longer stretches of time. Now, Basquiat's good friend Andy Warhol died on February 22, 1987. And as we just discussed, Basquiat had quite the addiction to heroin. But Warhol's death apparently is what spiraled him into a heavy state of depression and further drug use and abuse. In an effort to kick his heroin addiction, Basquiat actually left New York for Hawaii in 1988. He came back just a few months after leaving and claimed to be sober, but unfortunately he was not. If anything, the addiction had only gotten worse. According to those who were closest to him, in 1988, Basquiat was seriously considering quitting art. May be actually of surprise that at the height of his living fame and considering the growing fortune he was amassing, that he would be thinking about quitting what was conceivably his passion. But those closest to him suggest that he considered becoming a writer or running a tequila business in Hawaii. Not sure where that inspiration came from, but I'm sure the tranquil island breezes in Hawaii didn't hurt the development of that thought. But Basquiat's studio was a shrine to his unique and a bit of eccentric personality and demeanor. There was no name marked on the hugely thick metal door that sheltered his studio and loft from the neighborhood of crack dispensary and vagabonds. And the floors of the studio were always covered with unstretched canvases and altering and varying stage of completion. And considering his vast amount of work created, both titled and untitled, only one piece of visible artwork adorned the walls other than his own work. It was a portrait of himself and his dear friend Andy Warhol that hung near his kitchen sink. On August 12, 1988, Basquiat died of a heroin overdose at his art studio on Great Jones Street in Manhattan. He was only 27 years old. His body was discovered by a woman named Kelly Inman, who was a close friend and makeup artist actually living in the basement below his studio. In recounting her discovery, Inman says she first attempted to call Basquiat after a previous night of partying with him in New York, the first time he had actually been out of the house in a long while before while dealing with the depths of the depression, but she received no answer. She says she went upstairs into the studio and discovered Basquiat in a pool of vomit. Inman said that upon seeing him in that state, she was flooded with emotions. First fear, then calm, and then the odd sense that she felt relief that his struggle and pain and ordeal was now over, that he was deceased. His body is actually laid to rest in Brooklyn at Greenwood Cemetery with a modest but nice granite headstone. From 1983 until his death, Basquiat lived at his studio in Manhattan, located at 57 Great Jones Street. And in 2016, the Greenwich Village Society for Historical Preservation dedicated a plaque at the building to his life. Now, following Basquiat's death, his star never stopped shining. Even in death, his work has toured the world, with major exhibitions continuing to this day in Houston and Iowa, Alabama, Brooklyn, Puerto Rico, Los Angeles, amongst numerous other cities worldwide. Though only 27 at his death, and with a very short-lived career, Basquiat is credited with having brought the African-American and Latino experience into the elite art world. In just 8 short years, Basquiat produced about 600 major canvases. Now, my first time ever seeing a Basquiat in person was in Montreal a couple of years ago, and it sounds cliche, but the work was so much more beautiful in person than online images can portray. The work at first glance appeared to be so elementary, but just as mentioned before, his work is fully and completely adorned with hidden symbols and figures and numerals. And to be honest with you, the size of his work is awe-inspiring. But I'm sorry to digress. Since his death in 1988, the market for his work has just steadily increased, right along with other art markets. In 2007, when the height of the art market boomed globally, the global auction value and volume for Basquiat's work was over $115 million. The most coveted of his work is very rare and generally dates between 1981 and 1983. Until 2002, the highest amount paid for a Basquiat was $3.3 million when a piece was sold at Christie's on November 12, 1998. In 2002, however, a new record was set when the 1982 piece Prophet One was sold to Metallica's drummer Lars Ulrich for $5.5 million. In 2007, another untitled work by Basquiat was sold at Sotheby's in New York for a then record-setting $14.6 million. In 2008, Lars Ulrich put up a piece for work, another 1982 untitled piece commonly called Boxer, which many of you have likely seen before if you've ever seen a Basquiat work. You'll know it just by the name Boxer. And Lars Ulrich actually sold it for $13.5 million to an anonymous bidder. In 2012, for the second year in a row, Basquiat was the most coveted contemporary artist sold at auction, with over $102 million in auction sales over the year. In 2013, the piece Dust Heads sold at Christie's for $48.8 million. And in 2016, an untitled piece was sold at Christie's for $57.3 million to a Japanese collector. Now, I must put a caveat to this episode really quickly. This episode was actually started about a month before the release. So it was actually started before the most recent news of Basquiat. And I'll give you the most recent news now, just depending on kind of when you listen to it. On May 17th, 2017, Basquiat joined an elite club, the $100 million plus club. In 1982, Basquiat painted a skull, another one of his untitled works. Well, at Sotheby's auction house, that skull painting sold for $110.5 million. I'll say that number one more time. The skull painting that he painted in 1982 on May 17th, 2017, sold for $110.5 million. To become the sixth most expensive work ever sold at an auction. In auction history, only 10 other pieces have broken the $100 million mark before. In doing so, Basquiat joins the ranks of other elite artists such as Francis Bacon and Pablo Picasso. Not long after the auction was over, Japanese billionaire Yasuko Maezawa announced on his Instagram page that he was the buyer, stating, "I am happy to announce that I just won this masterpiece. When I first encountered this painting, I was struck with so much excitement and gratitude for my love of art. I want to share that experience with as many people as possible." Yasuko has said that he, prior to putting it in his private collection, intends to actually put the piece on a public display and tour it in exhibitions, and then plans to put it actually out on loan to some museums. And so if you are able to have an opportunity to view it if it comes to a city near you, I highly encourage it. Or you can just look at his Instagram page. His name is Yasaku Maezawa. I don't recall what his Instagram is. However, there's a New York Times article that features him in the painting pretty prominently. If you just Google or Bing May 17, 2017, or actually 18, 2017, because the article came out the day after, and put Basquiat and $100 million painting, or just Google or Bing Basquiat $100 million painting, I'm sure you'll find the piece and Yasaku Maezawa as well. Now, in eclipsing $100 million for a sale, Basquiat set a few records. He set the record for the highest any American artist's work has ever been sold for. He set a record for the highest amount any African American artist's work has ever been sold for. And probably the most pressing globally, he set the record for the first work created since 1980 to make over $100 million as well. The only downside that I would say to his paintings being sold for this much and valued at this much and with the reverence that acclaimed superstars like Beyonce and Jay-Z being fans of his work and actually owners of a few of his paintings, the only downside I would suggest to this fame is that he's not here to enjoy it. Obviously, him passing away, him passing away back in, 1988, and now we're looking at 2017, so almost 30 years after following his death, his work is revered. Now, that's not to say he didn't get to enjoy the fruits of his labors while he was living, but it's just a shame that these massive amounts of fortune that his paintings are going for now, he sees no parts of it. But in closing, I hope you truly enjoyed this episode, learned something interesting. Please be sure to check us out for updated topics. Subscribe to the show in iTunes and on the Google Play Store, depending on if you have an Android device or an iPhone. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, please feel free to check out our website at www.blackhistorypodcast.com or email us at info@thisiscarrington.com. Our webpage actually does have a contact us button. It's probably the easiest way to get a hold of us. The website is a bit out of date with regards to the episodes we've done, so I do apologize for that. The only thing I ask for is a little bit of patience as we get caught up, and I promise you won't be disappointed. Send us your feedback as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line to give us your thoughts or perspective to an episode we've done, this one included, we'll make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to future episodes. Please, as we take this journey together, we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light with some occasional commentary. But if you come across any errors or mistakes, please let us know. Because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and we'll see you next time.